I'm going to start with good news. I will not be talking about tax reform. More good news, I have slides. And my final piece, the speaker mentioned Tommy John and baseball. 5 weeks from yesterday, pitchers and catchers report for spring training. And the world is reborn. I'll be in a revenue tax committee meeting. So, not so good news. So, we saw the... I just said I wasn't going to talk about tax reform. But before I keep that promise, let me talk about tax reform. We just passed a major bill that addressed some problems that exist in the state's tax code. I gave a speech about this in the committee and on the floor. I'm not going to re-give that speech here. It didn't solve every problem. And I want to talk about some issues that still remain, how we can maintain. How many of you use Venmo? I thought it would be a lot. That's maybe a little bit more than I thought. So you guys have done Venmo, right? Like somebody buys your dinner and you send them the 20 bucks or whatever. When you transfer the money, right, somebody sends you the 20 bucks and it's time for you to, if you put that into your account, when do you do that, right? So you probably can't see it up there. But if you've ever had this experience, right, Venmo offers you two choices. We can send this money to you today or a few days from now. If we send it to you today, it costs you 1%. So on this transaction on the screen, it would cost you 35 cents to get the money in your account today. Or you can wait a few days and it'll be free. By show of hands, you guys have done this before. How many of you pay the 1% to get the money today? There's only one of you. How many of you wait a few days? Okay, fair enough. Me too. So I feel like I'm a cheapskate. I don't need the money that bad. But why does Venmo do it for free so that they can hold on to the money, right? What's in it for Venmo? I could answer my own question, but if one of you wants to, I'd be happy to take it. Yeah, so, I mean, they're making at least a little bit of money off of this float, right? I mean, if 10 million people are transferring $35, that's $350 million that Venmo is sitting on. And to let that money work for Venmo for 2 or 3 days, that's pretty good work for not much effort, right? That's what income tax is, right? So I've started asking two questions to people as they talk about this unnamed bill that we passed a few years ago that I promised I wasn't going to talk about. So as I ask people, would you rather that the government take more money from you or less money from you? I have never gotten the answer more. I sometimes get the answer, they need to take more money from other people. But I've never met a single person that does not claim the standard exemption on their income tax. You don't have to, right? You could claim zero. I've never met a person who qualified for it that didn't claim their mortgage interest or their charitable donations. All of these things are legal ways to reduce your tax burden that I think everybody takes advantage of. Because, really, taxpayers want, at least on an individual basis, to pay less in tax. So that's question one. And here's question two. So if the government is going to take some money from you in taxes to operate, would you rather that they take it from you as you earn it, withhold it from your paycheck before you ever see it, or as you spend it? And the answers to that aren't quite as clear cut, but I want to think about that in context of Venmo. Right? So if you get to hold, while that $350 million is working for Venmo, right, that $35 is not working for you. And that doesn't maybe mean that much to any individual Venmo user, right? It certainly doesn't mean that much to me. But to the state of Utah, if we are collecting revenue from people when they earn it, before they ever spend it, before they ever see it, we just take it right off the top. That money is now working for the government. And it's not working for the taxpayer, it's not working for the economy, right? It is not being saved and invested. On the other hand, if we let people keep more of the money that they earn and then collect it as they spend it, what we're doing is reducing taxes on earnings, on savings, and on investment, all things that contribute to a growing economy. If we really want our economy to thrive, we need to take further steps to rebalance our current tax structure between the income and the consumption-based tax. The tax on income is a tax on productivity. As taxpayers generally want to pay less, and if we accept the premise that people will respond to incentives and that tax incentives change people's behavior, if you're interested in paying less tax, and we collect 2/3 of the state revenue from the income tax, then the only way for people to pay less is either to earn less, which is a crazy incentive for the state to put in place, or to carve up the income tax with credits and exemptions, right? To complicate the tax code to benefit the way that I want to spend my money, right? Several industries are very good at doing this. But when you tax productivity, that is what you're going to get. People want to be productive, but they also want to pay less in tax. Therefore, a productivity tax will always be much more complicated than a consumption tax, which again adds to the tax burden and perversely makes what taxes are there less and less efficient. All right? You saw the little John Kerry thing that I put up there. I wasn't going to highlight those kinds of things, but I specifically picked an old one not to get involved in, you know, current political trends of the day. I believe that taxpayers want their dollars to work for them. I understand that it's natural that government would want taxpayer dollars to work for government, but I would just submit that that's the wrong thing for government to do. As a member of that government and that legislature, I want the dollars in our economy to work for the economy and to work for taxpayers. And therefore, I'm going to be making an argument here, right? To lessen the perverse incentives that the productivity tax has in place by modeling what some other states have done. I'm talking a little bit more about productivity and consumption, but I'm also trying to get everything a little bit back on pace here, right? Simply to say that the productivity tax or the tax on income is among the least efficient taxes that we can levy. The deadweight loss that's associated with collecting money from taxpayers as it's earned rather than as it's spent is higher than on a consumption tax. And if we want our tax system to be more efficient, we should err on the side of consumption rather than productivity taxes. It is also a major problem that everybody has touched on today, that the income tax is the most volatile tax we have. And Utah is unique in that this pot of money, this highly volatile pot of money, is exclusively for the use of public education. And I just think it is dangerous and irresponsible to tie what's got to be, if not the most, one of the top two or three most important functions of government to the least stable form of revenue. And that as the general fund has continued to, the growth in the general fund has continued to shrink, that we are nearing a situation where there's going to be some time in the not too distant future when the income tax takes a dip, and probably a fairly substantial dip in terms of the revenue that it generates. And the most dangerous thing for public education in that circumstance is a general fund with no capacity to pick up the slack. That's unique to Utah and not really a principle-based argument, right? We're just taking the principle that consumption taxes are a more efficient way to collect revenue, income taxes are least efficient. So I'm going to make an argument here that we need a further rebalancing of shifting between reducing the state's reliance on the revenue that's generated from the productivity tax. And I would suggest that we ought to do that by proactively setting targets in the future whereby when our strong economy and our solid best in the nation tax structure continues to generate the revenue that it is, and we continue to see massive growth in our income tax and education fund, that we will set targets by which the rate will decrease in the future consistent with that growth, so that we are proactively saying we are going to continue to shift our economy towards one that and our government operations towards one that's based on consumption and not a productivity tax. North Carolina did this 6 years ago. They were ranked like 48th in the country based on some measure. I don't think they were quite that low on the rich states, poor states measure. But you'll see they were like 36 or something. I can't see the slide from here. In 2013, Republicans took over and enacted massive tax structure reform, including huge reductions in the income, in the corporate income tax. And at the same time they did that, feeling confident that reducing tax rates and improving their tax structure would lead to a stronger economy through a more efficient tax system, they set targets in the future so that when revenue comes in at this much money, the rate goes down further. They, in 2013, they cut the tax rate to 4%. In 2019, it went down to 2.5% with no further action, right? An additional rate cut of 33% from 4 to 3.5 to 3 to 2.5%, because their economy has been growing so much because they are getting closer to the tax structure that Utah has in place. We can do the same thing by proactively setting targets. When our revenue generates that much money, the rate should automatically float down. In that way, we're still protecting public education's funding stream, but also improving our economy into a new, less reliance on the least efficient form of taxation. That's my argument, and I'll have legislation this session about that topic. And since I see many legislators in here, I hope I can get all your support. Thank you. Because I was standing next to Howard at the back, he asked me to take just a minute to talk to you about funding equity for public education. And so I've given this speech here before. You guys have heard it. I'm not going to repeat myself except to make this single argument. When we are choosing to increase funding for public education, it is obvious that we should increase funding faster for school districts and children that do not have the tax base on their own, right? When you look at Utah's education funding per student, you know, like, we're last in the country, right? But we're not, really, because Park City is like up at $14,000 per student, and in the Alpine School District, it's like $7,000 per student. That massive difference is what is creating our problem. We want to get everybody up to the Park City level, right? What we ought to do, instead of giving the exact same amount of money from the state to every kid, regardless of what district they live in, we should increase funding a little bit faster in Alpine than we do in Park City. I think that's obvious, and I hope we can get your support for that as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. So next up, you're going to want to pay attention to this one. This is going to be excellent. We're going to hear from our Utah State Tax Commissioner, Rebecca Rockwell. And as she's coming to the stage, I'll just tell you a little bit about her. She was appointed and confirmed in 2015. She's a state and local tax attorney with over two decades of experience in Utah state government. She has extensive knowledge of the Utah tax code, tax case law, and administrative rules and procedures, and we're excited to hear from her today. Welcome to the stage, Commissioner Rebecca.